Okay. Being very satisfied, the bull is meaningful. Okay. Being very satisfied by the bull's meaningful statements, Maharaj Parikit replied, O saintly one in the form of a bull, you know the truth about religion. One who thinks that the perpetrator of an irreligious act is the cause of his suffering is just as ignorant as the miscreant is. Because you have understood this, you must verily be the personality of religion. As a devotee, you are ready to tolerate all kinds of misery, considering it to be God sent. It is for this reason that you have not placed the blame on this Shudra that was beating your legs. The only conclusion is that the Lord's energies are inconceivable. No one can estimate them by mental speculation or by word jugglery. Nimisha 4, 23rd purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, A question may be raised as to why a devotee should refrain from identifying an actor, although he knows definitely that the Lord is the ultimate doer of everything. Knowing the ultimate doer, one should not pose himself as ignorant of the actual performer. To answer this doubt, the reply is that the Lord is also not directly responsible, for everything is done by his deputed Maya Shakti, or material energy. Material energy is always provoking doubts about the supreme authority of the Lord. The personality of religion knew perfectly well that nothing can take place without the sanction of the Supreme Lord, and still he was put into doubts by the deluding energy, and thus he refrained from mentioning the supreme cause. This doubtfulness was due to the contamination of both Kali and the material energy. The whole atmosphere of the age of Kali is magnified by the deluding energy, and the proportion of measurement is inexplicable. But here's that for the devotees, then, when you have senior personalities like this, then they are working on the principle of giving example to us, even though they themselves may not be in this position, like Arjuna on the battlefield. So in here, then, we have the influence of Kali and the material energy. Right, so this double thing is there. Material energy is already a problem. But it can be in other ages more pious and in this age less pious. Right? But both is there. So that is there. So now in doing this, then the Lord is seen as a cause. I mean, how you say, is one of the five factors of action. Right? But he is only carrying out what the living entity has already performed. Krishna already makes this statement. As you surrender, I reciprocate. So he's given the rules, and then the living entity then interacts within those rules. Based on that, then the Lord comes to him in that form. Does this make some sense? So it's not, even though Krishna's arranging it, he's not the doer. We've asked for it, just like if you go to the store and you say, give me that item. And the person the shopkeeper takes it off the shelf and gives it to you. Can't say, well, they're the cause for me. He just gave it to me. I don't know why it's, you know, or why is he giving me this? Or, well, he gave it to me, so what can I do? I'm using it. No, you wanted it, therefore they gave it. Right? If you didn't ask for it, they wouldn't give it to you. Right? Does that make some sense? So that's it. By our actions, within the framework set up by Krishna, we have the choice. And then doing that, then we get the result. So therefore, Krishna is in control, but he's not actually the cause of it. We're the cause of it. Otherwise, then the tendency is, okay, then this person is not the one, actual one, but it's Krishna. So Krishna is the one that's giving me trouble. But no, Krishna is only providing what trouble you want. Right? One may say, I don't want trouble. But everything goes together. Like, I like to eat as much as I like, but that means I also accept I'm going to be very full, right? And then the difficulty breathing and, you know, digestion and getting very thirsty and lethargic. You know what I'm saying? Just like the thief steals. Now he'll say, well, I was only interested in getting the goods, but in stealing means you put yourself up to also being punished. The two go together. Right? That's the thing. You buy yourself some material item, but then it has to be maintained. You have a house, You get yourself a house, but it has to be maintained. You can't just say, oh, I like the house part, but not the maintenance part. Does that make some sense? So that's the whole thing, is they go together. So when you accept the one, you are accepting the other. So, but when we get the other, then we think, oh, I didn't want this. But we did. Otherwise, why would we do the activity? There's always the idea, I'll do it and get away with it. Yeah, it won't get me. But they go together, you know. I'll drop the rock, but it won't hit the floor, you know. It doesn't work like that. I'll start a fire, but there'll be no heat and light, you know. It just doesn't work. Or I'll jump in the water, I won't get wet. You know, it's just, they go together. Does that make sense? Like that. So that means it's coming from us, so the person who is performing the activity is not the doer. And the Lord is the one operating it to make it work through His Maya Shakti, but He's not the cause of it either. So it actually just comes back to us. So as he points out here, is only a devotee could think like this, and in this understanding so clearly than Dharmaraj himself. Right? Because he knows all the things. Okay? Any questions on this? Maharaj Parikshit addressed Dharma in the form of a white bull. In Satyayuga, your four legs were established by the practice of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. Now, however, three of your legs have been broken due to rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. You are standing upon the last leg of truthfulness, and thus you somehow manage to still hobble along. Yet, since Kali is coral personified, and thus flourishes by deceit, he will also try to destroy your last remaining leg. Nimisha 5. The following excerpts from Srila Prabhupada's purports are most helpful to our understanding of these verses. The principles of religion do not stand on some dogmas or man-made formulas, but they stand on four primary regulative observances, namely austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. The mass of people must be taught to practice these principles from childhood. Austerity means to accept voluntarily things which may not be very comfortable for the body, but are conducive for spiritual realization. For example, fasting. Fasting twice or four times a month is a sort of austerity which may be voluntarily accepted for spiritual realization only, and not for any other purposes, political or otherwise. Fastings which are not meant for self-realization, but for some other purposes, are condemned in the Bhagavad Gita 17:5-6. Similarly, cleanliness is necessary both for the mind and for the body. Simply bodily cleanliness may help to some extent, but cleanliness of the mind is necessary, and it is effected by glorifying the Supreme Lord. No one can cleanse the accumulated mental dust without glorifying the Supreme Lord. A godless civilization cannot cleanse the mind because it has no idea of God. And for this simple reason, people under such a civilization cannot have good qualifications. However, they may be materially equipped. So the cleanliness we can see here is in these points of cleanliness, these four principles, they go much farther than what we would just think. Cleanliness, the whole purpose is cleaning the mind, cleaning the heart. The chitta, the consciousness is polluted. That's why it's called chitta. That it's polluted consciousness. It's not pure consciousness. Right? So the elements of bodily cleanliness are there, but then we also extend that to the how we're trying to create a pure environment. And in that, then there's the element of cleanliness, but there's the element of purity also. Just like question comes up, well, the water coming out of the tap in the bathroom, the water coming out of the tap in the kitchen are the same water. Why is one considered clean and one's not? Technically speaking, they're both the same water, so they're just as clean, right? But the difficulty comes is if you drink the water from the bathroom, you'll pollute the mind. Understand? Body may not become polluted, but the mind will become polluted. Does that make sense? Yes.
Somebody may say that it depends on our consciousness.
Someone may say it depends upon our consciousness. Yes, someone with good consciousness wouldn't say that. Someone with bad consciousness, they bring up these excuses. like that. Because if they're so conscious, then why is it Krishna's rule they don't want to follow it? You know what I'm saying? Then they're working on the platform like yoga, mystic thing, is that I have the powers to do what I like. So it's an independent thing. If my conscious right, I can do anything. Yeah, okay, yes, great in theory, but you're not doing everything. Because if your conscience is right, what's the problem in following it? Right? Anybody who has pure consciousness, there's no reason not to follow the rules. They don't have to follow the rules, but there's no reason not to. You know what I'm saying? Therefore, the Pandavas, there's no reason for them not to act as grihasthas and kings. Right? There's no reason for Prabhupada not to perform his duties as a grihastha and then as a sannyasi. There's no reason for them not to. It sets good example, because for them, they don't care. So if you don't care, you don't care if you do it or not do it. You understand? That's real consciousness. But if it's like, I don't need to do it, then that means it's polluted consciousness. Because someone who doesn't need to do it doesn't think I don't need to do it. It's not a question. You know, it's just like, do you need to bungee dive off a helicopter hanging over Hoover Dam? Do you need to do that? No, you don't even think about it, because it's not important to you. So if you're transcendental, it's not important to you, so you don't even think about it. So just that we make the comment, well, it depends upon your consciousness, when it's a matter of following direction that's given by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, then one is trying to say is that we're more transcendental than the Shastra. Or we're saying is I don't actually have to follow it, because that's the point, is they'll say it depends on consciousness. So saying that, having said that, will they follow it or not? If they do follow it, then they're trying to point out that consciousness is more important than the rule. But if they don't follow it, then they're trying to point out that I'm independent, I do what I like, and I use the excuse of Krishna consciousness.
Usually I concur to such things, and such statements indicate that somebody has some philosophy behind it.
Yes. He's saying that those who say that, they have some philosophy. That's theirs, because they're trying to rationalize their improper consciousness. Because the point is the Vedic literatures are very broad. It's about Krishna, so Krishna is everything, so it's connected to everything. So you can take any verse, and if you're clever enough, you can connect it to any philosophy. You know? That's why there's 6 Vedic philosophies. Right? Because all of them, and that's going from gross, physics, you know, of just everything's atoms and there is no soul and everything's just chemicals, up to, you know, the highest levels of Brajavakti. So you can interpret it, everything in between. That's why we need Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Because then we know what's the actual proper way to interpret it. Otherwise we make up our own interpretation and we come up with so many things. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's why sometimes even devotees are wary of quotes by Prabhupada, because you can turn them any way you like if you're clever enough. But the point is that there's a principle that's being given and that has to be followed. Right? So why would you bring up consciousness when there's a rule? You know, unless by following that rule it lowers the consciousness. But we're talking about it purifies the consciousness, it purifies the heart, therefore the consciousness will be better. Therefore one doesn't drink water in the bathroom. Otherwise, why would you drink water in the bathroom unless when you grew up your mother kept the cup, glass cup, you know, in the little rack with the toothbrushes on each side there, and that's where you drank the water. So all you're saying is that, you know, I'm just doing how I grew up. I'm not willing to actually make any adjustments for Krishna. That's okay. If you want to do that, great. But don't claim that it's equal. Claim that I'm attached. This is what I like. It's comfortable. You know, it's so much more difficult to walk into the kitchen and get a glass of water and then walk out of the kitchen and drink it. It's so easy to just walk into the bathroom, you know, fill the cup up, drink it, and then put it back without even rinsing it. You know, that's easy. But false ego won't allow us.
The problem is they think that they are above those rules.
Yeah, problem they think they're above the rules. But in the material world, it's a reflection. so the above is down. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing. They don't know that they're, when they look up, they're looking down. So that's a problem. The Vedas warn us not to go to the darkest of ignorance, but to the progressive path of light. The Lord Himself also warns that the deluding power of material energy is too powerful to overcome. But one who completely surrenders unto the Lord can easily do so. But the surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord is also not very easy. Such surrender is possible by persons of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. These four principles of advanced civilization were remarkable features in the age of Satya. In that age, every human being was practically a qualified brahmana of the highest order. And in the social orders of life, they were all paramahamsas, or the topmost in the renounced order. By cultural standing, the human beings were not at all subjected to the deluding energy. Yeah, by cultural standing here means that culturally they do everything right. They may be, you know, some may be impersonalist, some may be personalist. So there is some element of the material energy there. But as far as culturally following everything and doing everything properly, that there was no flaw in the Satya Yuga. Such strong men of character were competent enough to get away from the clutches of Maya. But gradually as the basic principles of Brahminical culture, namely austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness, became curtailed by proportionate development of pride, attachment for women, and intoxication. The path of salvation, or the path of transcendental bliss, retreated far away, far, far away from the human society. With the progression of the age of Kali, people are becoming very proud and attached to women and intoxication. By the influence of the age of Kali, even a pauper is proud of his penny. The women are always dressed in overly attractive fashion to victimize the minds of men, and the man is addicted to drinking wine, smoking, drinking tea, and chewing tobacco, etc. All these habits, the so-called advancement of civilization, are the root causes of all irreligiosities, and therefore it is not possible to check corruption, bribery, and nepotism. Man cannot check all these evils simply by statutory acts and police vigilance, but he can cure the disease of the mind by the proper medicine, namely advocating the principles of Brahminical culture, or the principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. Modern civilization and economic development are creating a new situation of poverty and scarcity with the result of blackmailing the consumers' commodities. If the leaders and the rich men of society spend 50% of their accumulated wealth mercifully for the misled mass of people and educate them in God consciousness, the knowledge of Bhagavatam, certainly the age of Kali will be defeated in its attempt to entrap the conditioned souls. We must always remember that false pride or too high an estimation of one's own values of life, undue attachment to women or association with them, and intoxication will divert human civilization from the path of peace. However, such people can clamor for peace in the world. The preaching of the Bhagavatam principles will automatically render all men austere, clean both inside and outside, merciful to the suffering, and truthful in daily behavior. That is a way of correcting the flaws of human society, which are prominently exhibited at the present moment. Yeah, here's interesting is that here, because sometimes it's devotees will get confused that they will take actually, that's another thing. Okay, so Prabhupada's pointing out these four things are being followed. Then the society will work. It's that simple. Right? Because from these four, then everything else is based on that. Right? Like that. Because to be merciful, there must be tolerance. There must be forgiveness. You can't be merciful if there's no forgiveness. Right? Someone's done something wrong. When he's saying give mercy, mercy means for a situation that it may deserve something else. right? Someone has done something incorrect, but that's being forgiven, right? That's mercy. Does that make sense? So if the sense of justice is too strict and missing the point of the cultural interactions and all that, then there's no mercy. Same time as there's not sentimentality. Right? Because, in other words, the person must be benefited. So if they've changed the consciousness, that by showing that, then showing that mercy will enliven them to continue that, pursue that. Right? They change the consciousness, you're kind to them, therefore they will be inspired to continue in that direction. Does that make sense? Because you're encouraging them. But if there's no change, it's only a show, then it's better it's not shown. Does that make some sense? Any questions on this? So we see Prabhupada very brings this up very, you know, this is the foundation. In other words, these four are Brahminical culture. And Brahminical culture is the common culture. It's not, there's not separate cultures for Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras. There's only one Vedic culture, and that's Brahminical. Does that make sense? That's all. It's not, this idea is different. It's not. It's all the same culture. It's just that to what degree you can follow it, that's all. The Brahmins perfectly follow it. Kshatriyas can, some don't. Vaishyas could follow it, may follow it a little bit less. You know what I'm saying? In other words, Brahmins will follow it. Kshatriyas will follow it, but if they're not, then it'll drop a little bit. Vaishyas will follow it, but if they don't, then it'll drop a little more. Shudras will follow it. If they don't follow it, it drops even more. Does that make sense? It's just the nature. The king now addressed Mother Earth, who stood before him in the form of a cow. Your burden of having to maintain the world's population was certainly diminished by the personality of Godhead, and by others as well. When he was present as an incarnation, all good was performed on your surface because of his auspicious footprints. Now, O chaste one, finding yourself unfortunately forsaken by the personality of Godhead, you lament your future with tears in your eyes. As this age of Kali descends upon us, lower class men who pose as rulers rush in to lord over and enjoy you. Yeah, notice here is because we discussed before, we're dealing with emotions here. So, very clearly, he's establishing Bhumi's position in relationships. Right? Does that make sense? So, that being established, who she is and what's going on, then that the Lord was taking care of and all this means that she takes care of everyone, the Lord was creating an ideal atmosphere, and so now with him being God, then now people are harassing you, and you know, does that make some sense? Because then it's very easy. If you just say, oh, you're being harassed by the people of Kali Yuga, you might say yes, you might not, because that's the result. But the actual position is that without the Lord, then there's a problem. You know what I'm saying? So that's why it's important to establish all these things. If one is ever in a conversation with someone else who has a problem, after hearing what they said, then you make your comment, and then they say, you don't understand, right? Even though it's quite obvious logically that what you said was correct, then it's because you didn't use this method, right? This is the method. Right? Because then if you show what is the field that they're working in, who they are, what they're doing, what the relationships are, what is therefore the ideal, then what is causing the problem, and then what is your conclusion, then the person will say you understand. Right? So it's an important communication skill. It's important social, you know, how you say, it's just a proper way of communicating because you're dealing with the mind. This is how you deal with the mind. When you deal with the intelligence, then you immediately get to the point and then expand it, because then the intelligences then can distinguish, and then based on that, then you bring out this element's been distinguished, that element. You know, like we say, this area here, there's a floor, there's columns, and there's a ceiling. Right? Then it's okay, clear, that's how you're dividing it up into three. So, because intelligence divides things and puts things together. Okay, so all the elements here have been divided into three. So we've divided it and we've categorized them. Right? Like that. So then we can point out, so the column therefore is like this, the floor is like this, the ceiling's like this. Then we can expand on it, you know what you're doing. Well, if I just go, well, you know, the floor's like this, and, you know, the columns are like this, and the ceiling's like that, you're going, so what's the point? Right? And so you, intellectually you're frustrated. So you say the point first, then you expand. But if it's an emotional thing, you don't just say the point, then otherwise it's frustration. You have to say everything around it. You know? Does that make some sense? Very... Yes, that's the point, is that you have to be able to see their perspective and everything like that. Then you gradually bring it to what you think is going to be beneficial. But you have to start from there and go there. The other one is you're starting from the point and bringing it to them. You know, that's the difference. Intellectually, you make the point, and then you show practically how to make it from theory into practice. And when you're doing the other way, when it's emotion, then you empathize with them. You start with them and then bring it to where they should be going. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the whole... Because from the mind, you get your values. That establishes your path, where you're going. The intelligence is knowing what you're dealing with and then how to practically apply it. Does that make sense? Yes. Yeah, that's the whole point. It means... That's the whole point. Yeah, is that if it's not emphasized, they will not feel you understand what is being said.
You might not actually get the point.
Yeah.
Unless you actually see it from their perspective, you won't be able to get
yeah.
the point.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that make sense? Right. So, okay. Implacably determined to halt the, you know, implacably determined to halt the progress of Kali. The noble and powerful Maharaj Parikit unsheathed his sharp sword to kill the miscreant Shudra, who was mockingly attired in the finery of the royal order. When Kali saw the seriousness of the king's intentions, he at once cast off his imitation royal dress and bowed down his head in surrender. At this, the righteous Maharaj Parikit refrained from killing Kali. Smiling compassionately, the king said, "Since you have surrendered yourself unto me with folded hands, you need no longer fear for your life. However, I cannot allow you to remain within my kingdom, for you are the friend of irreligion. Wherever you stay, greed, falsehood, robbery, incivility, treachery, misfortune, cheating, quarrel, and vanity will abound. You do not deserve to reside in a place where God-conscious persons perform sacrifices according to religious principles for the satisfaction of the Supreme Lord." Right? So here we see he's determined, but he's not stubborn. Right? It's a very important thing, is that here he's made the determination he's going to punish, but when the mentality is corrected, there's surrender, then it's not, well, I have to punish, we have to set good example, this is good example. Right? This is good example. There's never been a time in history where someone has corrected the consciousness, surrendered, and then just out of set a good example, they're punished in exactly the same way as before they've changed the consciousness, and it didn't create problem. There's no example in history. It's only a figment of bureaucrats' imagination. That following the letter of the law that's written on the paper that sits on the piled on their desk will actually control society. Society is looking for leaders. Leaders are people. People consider other people. So the point of the punishment is you're wrong, so you're being corrected. If you've corrected the mentality, then we can make adjustment. But he doesn't lower his standard. He's not sentimental. Oh, so now you can just move around as you like. No, he's not killed. But he's banished. And when he banished because his whole kingdom is everywhere, he has to give, then he's given an appropriate place. So everything is very carefully thought about and worked out. Does this make sense? This is leadership. This is correct. This is setting the example. Does that make some sense? So these are good points. Suta Goswami comments here that when Kali received this order from Maharaj Pariksit, he began to tremble with fear. As the king loomed threatening over him, just like Yamaraj, Kali pleaded, "O chief among protectors of religion, since you are the emperor of the entire world, wherever I may go, I will see you with sword in hand, ready to punish me for my sinful activities." Right? It means he has to do these things. Right? It's him. You know, okay, so if Kali does these things, he can get away with it, because that's what he is. Right? Everybody else has got a problem. But, you know. "Even though I am your enemy, because I have surrendered unto you, you should allot me a place of residence where I can live peacefully under your protection." Being thus petitioned, Maharaj Pariksit agreed to allow Kali to live there, live where gambling, intoxication, prostitution, and animal slaughter were being indulged in. However, since such places practically did not exist within Maharaj Pariksit's kingdom, Kali felt cheated. He begged for something more. In response, Maharaj Pariksit finally agreed that he could live where gold was being kept, or in such places, for in such places there is invariably falsity, intoxication, lust, envy, and enmity. Because right? At that time there wouldn't be practically a place for him. You know, you might catch a few tribals here and there, but you know, it's kind of, you know, cold in the out in the forests of Europe and stuff like that, you know. But where gold is, then bad qualities will be there. So at least he can manifest some of his personality. Thereafter, Maharaj Pariksit carefully reestablished the lost legs of Dharma within his kingdom. Then, for encouraging activities meant to improve the condition of the earth, he collected all of the illicitly held gold that had been kept for furthering the activities of Kali and engaged it in the Sankirtan Yajna, 40-45, Dimisha. Purport 42, it is confirmed by Srila Prabhupada that Maharaj Pariksit seized all the gold earmarked for sinful activities and used it to promote Sankirtan throughout his kingdom. Quote, "Maharaj Pariksit therefore, like his grandfather Arjuna, collected all illicit gold kept for the propensities of Kali and employed it in the Sankirtan Yajna, as per instruction of the Srimad Bhagavatam." So the problem is not gold. Here he's saying hoarded gold. Hoarded means there's no purpose to it other than all these bad qualities. But so much opulence may be there that's properly engaged in the Lord's service. That's not a problem. It means the king himself has, you know, unlimited gold. But it's not a problem. But where the gold is being hoarded so it can be used in sinfully, that's where Kali can reside. Means he has a special treasury for that, but it's not his. You know, because you have to keep it somewhere before you to distribute it. Yeah, like that. He'll put it in the river. Because then he's put in the river, he's offering it to Varuna. And Varuna has ruling over all kings. He's like the supreme authority. So it can be offered to Varuna, or it can be given to the Brahmins. Because it mentions that a Kshatriya, when he turns the kingdom over to the next ruler, over to the sun, before he leaves for the forest or for the battlefield, he should clear out that treasury, whatever's been collected from fines. And it's specifically, it means general fines are there, but anything that's a fine from a mortal sin, you know, killing Brahmins, illicit activity, like this, that fines, that he can't use. The other things can be used for the state. You know, somebody's done small things and they've broken some laws. That can be used to fix roads and all that. But the for mortal sins, that can't be. So that he has to clear out before he leaves, because the next ruler may not know or may get mixed up or may get attracted by it. So it has to be cleared before he leaves. Like that. So these are all parts of it.
On previous,
huh? In modern states, they use that number. Yeah, of course. Well, that's why you see that the heads of state, basically after they've been head of state, either in office or just after office, they're basically, you know, either die or killed or turn into vegetables. Yes.
In previous sentence, it was said that Maharaj Parikshit agreed for Kali to stay in the place where gold was kept. So is it, it seems like it was the request of Kali for it, or did Maharaj Parikshit just knew actually the weak places?
No, he just begged for one place more. So he said, you can stay. Because he has to find him a place, because that's the king. The king has to understand the nature of who he's dealing with. That's why someone who cannot follow means, in other words, if you can't understand yourself, who you are, and functioning within the social order, right, the devotional order and the social order, unless you can understand that, you can't therefore interact with others. Right? And if you can't interact with others, you cannot lead others. Right? So in other words, the leader, someone qualified for leadership, is one who knows how to relate based on the law, because he knows who he is. Right? So that's the thing, is that as a king, he has to know what is the nature of everybody within his system. And he knows what is outside his system. And what's their nature. So then he will suitably choose a place for him. So he knew where gold is hoarded for sense gratification, there all the bad qualities are there. So he also then goes around and collects all that gold, so it makes it very difficult for Kali to find a place, but you know, I'm sure there's somebody here or there. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the point. The king's not going by his own opinion or feelings, he's going by what Shastra says. And he knows that, and he knows it practically. That's why he's a king. He knows it, he knows it practically, and he's willing to apply it. The Brahmins know it, and may or may not know it practically if it's not their field. If they know it practically because it's their field, but they don't apply it, the king applies it. Right? They're ministers. They tell the king what should be done, and they know practically how it works. And those Brahmins who don't know practically how it works, they don't advise kings. Right? Philosophy maybe, but not in practical things. They don't. You know what I'm saying? Means Drona knows how to manage. So he can advise the king how to manage. But because he's the Brahmin, he doesn't do it himself. But he can do it. They make him the general of the army. He has no problem. But then he's stepping down to the Kshatriya level. So he can do it, but as a Brahmin he doesn't. Right? But if he's just situated within the Brahminical activities, it's not his field, then he doesn't advise. Like that. So that's the thing. If you can't do it, don't advise. You know? And only those who can do it, they should be taking the role and leading. Like that. So that's the Vedic. This modern thing of just everybody says whatever they want because they feel they have the right, it doesn't work in the Vedic culture, because it doesn't work anywhere. There's no successful entity on the planet that functions by that. There's not one. Any business, any administrative thing, anything that goes on, it goes on because those who are qualified are doing it, and those who are not qualified are not doing it. Right? So we have a situation where unqualified people are doing, and they're proud of it. You know, it's not just emergency. And everybody feels they have the right to say everything about everybody else. That's called chaos. So you don't get anything. It's a kichari. So therefore, you won't have brahmacharis, you won't have grihasthas, you won't have pandit, you won't have sannyasis, you won't have brahmacharis. Because it's a kichari. A brahmin's a brahmin because he does those things. Kshatriya is kshatriya because he does those things. Grihastha, he does these. Sannyasa does that. Brahmachari does. Then it's clear. But if everybody does everything, then it doesn't work. You know? Yes.
There is a system of Daivi Varnashram also.
Say again?
There is a system of Daivi Varnashram.
There is a?
Daivi Varnashram, in which any person can do any activity like that.
Anyone? any person can do any activity that is appropriate. You know what I'm saying? Anybody, but you choose that. Just like you choose to be a grihastha, then you're a grihastha. It's not today I'm a grihastha and tomorrow I'm the sannyasi and the next day I'm the vanaprastha and like that, yes. See, in other words, what we're talking about is anyone doing anything, that aspect means anyone in Daivavarnashram is automatically a Brahmin, right? So that means devotionally anyone can do anything. Does that make sense? Means you may be a properly situated, second initiated devotee who, as an occupation, you make money as a Shudra. But it doesn't mean that you can't do the puja. Or can't give a class or lead a kirtan. Because you qualify because of the devotional aspect. But because you're a Shudra, you shouldn't be telling Brahmins how to do, you know, what's occupationally there, how to teach, or something that you don't know. Right? Unless you're coming into teaching because of the preaching, which is the Brahminical culture. Right? So as you advance in devotional service, what you're doing looks more like Brahminical activities. But it's coming in because of the consciousness. You know what I'm saying? But you can't tell the managers how to manage if you don't know how to manage. You know what I'm saying? You pick a situation that you connect it to Krishna. You decide, I'm a brahmachari, I'm a grihastha. But you choose that and then engage that. But what it means is that it's not that only those who are, you know, quote-unquote Brahmins can be involved in the deity worship. Right? Anyone who, by the pancharatric process, therefore has become has accepted the Brahminical status, they can do. You know what I'm saying? So the only difference between the Daiva Varnashram and the ordinary Varnashram is that Daiva means it's all done for Krishna. Therefore, those things that are not meant for Krishna, like worship the demigods and Shraddha rites and those, you can drop off. Right? Because you're worshiping the demigods, but Krishna is the supreme. He's the lord of the demigods. You're worshiping the forefathers, but Krishna is the, you know, Pita Maha. He's Brahma's, you know, father. So, you know what I'm saying? You can't get better than that. Right? So, you don't have to, you know, you're doing the sacrifices like this, but you're sacrificing to Vishnu. So you don't have to do all these others. So it's exactly Varnashram. It's not that we change. It's a misnomer thinking that, oh, we don't follow it. No, we follow it. We follow what's actually the real. Daiva Varnashram is the real Varnashram. The others are expanded so that you can accommodate everybody who's at least willing to follow the basic principles of human life. They're not interested in God, but they'll follow the scriptures. God's written the scriptures, so indirectly they're worshiping the Lord. But because they don't know that, they don't get that result. Right? They get a pious result. They go to the heavenly planets, they get wealthy, they get beautiful, they get powerful, a lot of these kind of things. Right? But it's just like Pancharatra is the Vedic literature that you clear out anything that's not to do with Vishnu and just leave what's to do with Vishnu. That's called Pancharatra. Right? Like that. Does that make sense? And the Bhagavat means it's only, you don't have to clear it out. It is the original form. You know what I'm saying? To apply that to others, then it's been expanded as the Vedic, and the Pancharatra is then the essence of that. Does that make sense? So that's where we situate ourselves. We're actually situating ourselves within the Pancharatra. From that, then we engage ourselves as much as possible in the Bhagavat, because that's what we're trying to get to. And we take advantage of the Varnashram aspects that are connectable nicely to Krishna. Does that make sense? So we're not actually situating ourselves purely in the Vedic, because in this age you can't do it all perfectly. There'll be a flaw. So we're situating ourselves in the Pancharatrik. And then from there, engaging in the Vedic and the Bhagavad, you know. But our underlying is Bhagavad. That's what we're trying to get to. Right? Means our qualification even to deal in the Pancharatrik is only because of the Bhagavad, because of chanting the holy name. We're not even qualified enough to follow that. You know, even though the Vedic is a lower standard, we don't have the qualification to do it. Right? You have the Vedic and the Treta Yuga, the Pancharatrika and the Dwapara Yuga. We don't have the qualification. So it's only by the potency of the Bhagavat, which is from the Satya Yuga, that we in the Kali Yuga can even advance up to the, and follow the Pancharatra and from that be able to apply the Vedic things. Does that make sense? Okay. 17.4. Okay, now on the questions. In verse 30, Sutta answers question 21. Okay, that's from 16.3. The meaning of his answer is thus seen. You have this thing? 16.3. What is that? 16.3. Means the previous chapter. Anyone has it? 16.3. Can you just read what's the question? That's question 21. Oh no. Answer's 21.
Question 21. Why did Maharaj Parikshit simply punish but not kill the personality of Kali? Since he was the lowest of the Shudras, having dressed as a king and having
struck
a cow on
bread. Okay. Okay, you all hear? Okay. So now this question is answered here in verse 30. Even an ordinary Kshatriya does not kill a surrendered person. And what to speak of Maharaj Parikshit, who is by nature compassionate and kind to the poor? He was smiling because the artificially dressed Kali had disclosed his identity as a lower class man. And he was thinking how ironic it was that although no one was saved from a sharp sword when he desired to kill, the poor lower-class Kali was spared by his timely surrender. Maharaj Parikshit's glory and kindness are therefore sung in history. He was a kind and compassionate emperor, fully worthy of accepting surrender even from his enemy. Thus the personality of Kali was saved by the will of Providence. So here is where it says that he was qualified to accept surrender. Because here, an enemy is able to be protected by Maharaj Parikshit, but at the same time, he won't be overcome by him. You know what I'm saying? But he's able to protect. It's said in the Nectar Devotion that because Krishna is so, stable or steady in his word, and he does exactly what he says, that the demons, the asuras on the lower planets, can sleep peacefully at night because they know Krishna is not going to come and bother them if they don't do something worth being bothered for. Right? They know Krishna has given them that place, and as long as they just do what they're doing down there, Krishna won't bother them. As soon as they come out of that place and go up to the heavenly planets and try to take over, that's not their business. Then Krishna is going to come and bother them. You know what I'm saying? So this is the point, is it's qualified that even an enemy can feel protected and peaceful because of the good qualities. He knows if he does just what he's supposed to, he will be protected, even though he's an enemy. Right? Does that make sense? You see, like Jarasandha, the Pandavas and Krishna, they're enemy. But he is able to give them facility and everything like that. He's not disturbed by them. He doesn't let them make any tricks or any politics. But at the same time, as he's able to extend himself and deal in a cultured way. Does that make sense? So that's a qualified person that can be surrendered to. right? Because they know what is surrender. They know what they should do. Right? That's the thing. Question 23. The Srimad Bhagavatam is asked by Maharaj Purkit of the personality of Kali. Question 22 was asked and answered in the previous chapter. Question 23. King Purkit asked Kali to identify himself, then ask if he dared beat a cow and bull because Lord Krishna and Arjuna are out of sight. Not waiting for a reply from Kali, Purkit then asked the bull question 24 of Srimad Bhagavatam. King Purkit asked the bull to identify himself and ask if he is really a demigod. He asked who cut off three of the bull's legs. 17.5. In verses 17 to 20, the bull replies, after praising Maharaj Purkit, the bull declined to say who he was and who had cut his three legs, pleading that different philosophies of causation conflicted one another. He left it to the king to ascertain his identity and the cause of his suffering. Maharaj Purkit answers questions 23 and 24 for himself. Noting the bull's pious unwillingness to accuse his attacker, the king identifies the bull as Dharma. Purkit says the distress of the bull and the cow is caused by the arrival of the age of Kali in the form of the black man dressed as a king. All this had transpired by the jugglery of the Lord's energies, beginning with the time factor. Philosophical significance of the questions and answers of chapter 17 are thus summarized in five parts as derived from the first to the 45th verses in the purports. 1. Kali continues because no Kshatriya king is present to suppress its irreligious activities. Purports 1 to 6. 2. Such a king rules according to the scriptures and never allows offenseless citizens to be disturbed by irreligious offenders. 17 to 16. This is important, very important to note, because in the modern situation, there is a, let's say, in trying to correct improper dealing with people that would be considered not socially of a standard, let's say, of those who are in the position of authority and power that they don't appreciate, either by improper behavior or they just don't like their behavior. So, improper dealings with such class by such unqualified leaders, then a more sophisticated social system tries to adjust that, but unfortunately sentimentally. So what they do is they make, concessions for those who are being oppressed at present. But in doing so, then those who are offenseless citizens become oppressed. Does this make sense? Like in the modern society, in some of the, you know, quote-unquote developed countries, let us say a thief breaks into your house and then you notice he's there and you call out and come running. He gets scared and he runs and jumps out an open window, but he thinks it's on the first floor. He doesn't know that you've created a lower basement there, and he falls down there and breaks his leg. He sues you because you didn't have a sign there saying, my dear thief, if you jump out this window, hey, you know, or you didn't provide a ladder, right? Or the guy comes, breaks into your house, he has a knife and all that, and he tries to attack you and your family, but in doing so, you don't just pull out a knife and just how much he cuts you, cut him back, you pull out a gun and blow him away. So then you get sued or you get put in jail because the punishment given back was more than appropriate, even though the guy would probably be very willing to kill you and your family. But you just did it first, so you get blamed. So this is not leadership, because the offenseless citizens are being oppressed by those who are improperly behaving. It's good to understand that, okay, if someone's being punished, they should only be punished only how much is there. They should not be put under undue strain beyond what is deserving. That's okay. But it shouldn't be that they're allowed now to oppress citizens who don't deserve to be. Does that make sense? That's why you need Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Because sentiment never gives a good result purely. There must be in sentiment with intelligence, right? Tattva and rasa go together. If you only have tattva, it'll be dry. If you only have rasa, it'll be sentimental. That's why the devotional path is the path in the middle. It's a perfect balance between the two. Otherwise, you get impersonalism, you get sahajya. Like this. Does that make some sense? Three, sometimes to prove a point, as the Lord did when he put Bhumi and Dharma in trouble, to demonstrate to the world that Maharaj Parikit was the ideal executive head, the Lord uses his devotees and even causes them distress. Because those devotees aren't bothered by the distress. Whether it's good or bad, they'll always remember the Lord, because that's perfection. Kunti was saying, us being in distress in the forest, we were always thinking it was so much better than now that we're reestablished. Justice has been, you know, enacted, we're reestablished on the throne and we have everything and all that. It's not, she says, it was better when it was worse, right? You know, so that's the that's the real application. Does that make sense? Okay. So therefore trouble may come. We sometimes think we turn to religion, therefore no trouble should come. But the point is we turn to religion to become uplifted. And that means remembering God. That's where the real taste is. Okay. Four, the importance of a qualified king in removing the influence of Kali must be understood by this citizenry, who should not succumb to sentimentality. Ineffective programs of social reform alluded to by Srila Prabhupada in the sentence from Purport 25, which is a reference to a pseudo-spiritual political ploy by which Mohandas Gandhi misled millions of Indian people. Fastings which were meant not for self-realization but for some other purposes are condemned in the Bhagavad Gita 17:5-6. Right? Yeah, because he says not for politics. And then here. In the absence of a real leader like Maharaj Parikit, the systematic education offered to the citizens in the Bhagavatam. It's interesting, he used Mohan Das, he didn't say Mahat. In the absence of a real leader like Maharaj Parikit, the systematic education offered to the citizens in the Bhagavatam and the performance of the Samkirtan Yajna will accomplish the same. Right? So, yeah. And five, cooperation between the Brahmins and a bona fide Kshatriya ruler will bring success to the state. Right, so those are the significances that are brought out by these questions here. Right. Anything on this? Or? No. Parishishtam, the appendix. So, Vinodakam. Three verses from the chapter 17, often quoted by Prabhupada. Tapaso cham daya satyam iti pada krite krita. Adharmam shaish tarayo bhagna. Smaya Sangha Madaistava. In the age of Satya, truthfulness, four legs were established by the four principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. But it appears that three of your legs are broken due to the rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. Places where Kali resides. Abhyartitas tatatasmai stanam kalaye dadao. Yutam panam striyasuna yata dhanamas chaturvida. Suta Goswami said, Maharaj Parikit, thus being petitioned by the personality of Kali, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter were performed. Punascha yacha manaya jata rupam adat prabhu tato naritam madam kamam rajo vairam cha panchamam. The personality of Kali asked for something more, and because of his begging, the king gave him permission to live where there is gold, because wherever there is gold, there is also falsity, intoxication, lust, envy, and enmity. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur categorizes these two verses from chapter 17 under the Prayojana section of Bhagavat Arkramichimala. In chapter 8, titled Bhatta Jiva Lakshanam, Characteristics of the Conditioned Soul. Okay, Prayojana section in chapter, okay. So in other words, by following the correctness of this, the soul can move towards the ultimate goal. But without it, then he won't. Sutta Goswami said, Maharaj Prakrit, being thus petitioned by the personality of Kali, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, animal slaughter were performed. Okay. Oh, no, it's the same thing. Okay. So anything more on this? Or questions? Okay. So then, today is Monday, right? So tomorrow then we'll continue with the appendix on the important quotes from the purports. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktavinda ki.